Body aches at bedtime? Sierracil is a natural mineral supplement that supports joint health, calms inflammation, and we're so sure it'll work for you as it has for me and my husband for over 10 years. It has a money-back guarantee. Go to sierracil.com, S-I-E-R-R-A-S-I-L, and use the code TRIFT for 14% off. Well, hello. My name is Erin. Welcome to Drift. Made possible by Envy Pillow. Created by two registered nurses in Canada, Envy Pillow has a unique ergonomic design to reduce wrinkles, help with TMJ pain, and align your neck and spine. Learn more in the morning at Envy, E-N-V-Y, pillow.com. This sleep story is from the renowned author F. Scott Fitzgerald. Perhaps you know the tale from the film starring Brad Pitt. Maybe you're a fan of Mr. Fitzgerald's writing, as in The Great Gatsby, and so much more. I love this story because it imagines what life would be like if we began old and became younger as time went on. Before we get into the first four chapters of this amazing short story, edited for this podcast, let me tell you that it's in two parts. So, if you fall asleep before we're done this part, well, good. That's what Drift is all about. I promise you that in part two, we'll recap what you've missed. So, cuddle in. Take a few deep inhales and exhales. Let your body become heavy in your bed. Let go of the cares that are resting on your shoulders. Relax your face, your mouth, your eyes. Nestle into your covers. Find that perfect place on your pillow. And we will begin. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Chapter 1. As long ago as 1860, it was the proper thing to be born at home. So young Mr. and Mrs. Roger Button were 50 years ahead of style when they decided one day in the summer of 1860 that their first baby should be born in a hospital. The Roger Buttons held an enviable position, both social and financial, in antebellum Baltimore. This was their first experience with the charming old custom of having babies. Mr. Button was naturally nervous. He hoped it would be a boy, so that he could be sent to his alma mater, Yale College, in Connecticut. On a September morning, he arose nervously at 6 o'clock, and hurried through the streets of Baltimore to the hospital. When he was approximately 100 yards from the Maryland Private Hospital for Ladies and Gentlemen, he saw Dr. Keene, the family physician, descending the front steps. Mr. Roger Button, the president of Roger Button and Company Wholesale Hardware, began to run toward Dr. Keene with much less dignity than was expected from a southern gentleman of that picturesque period. "Dr. Keene," he called. "Is the child born?" begged Mr. Button. Dr. Keene frowned. "Why, yes, I suppose so, after a fashion." He threw a curious glance at Mr. Button. "Is my wife all right?" "Yes." "Is it a boy or a girl?" "Here now," cried Dr. Keene, in a perfect passion of irritation. "I'll ask you to go and see for yourself. Outrageous. And get another doctor. I brought you into the world, young man. And I've been physician to your family for 40 years, but I'm through with you. I don't want to see you or any of your relatives ever again. Goodbye." Then he turned sharply, and without another word, climbed into his carriage and drove away. Mr. Button stood there upon the sidewalk, stupefied and trembling from head to foot. What horrible mishap had occurred? But he forced himself to mount the steps and enter the hospital's front door. A nurse was sitting behind a desk in the opaque gloom of the hall. Swallowing his shame, Mr. Button approached her. "Good morning," she remarked, looking up at him pleasantly. "Good morning. I am Mr. Button." At this, a look of utter terror spread itself over the girl's face. "Oh, of course," she cried. "Upstairs, upstairs, right upstairs. Go up." She pointed the direction, and Mr. Button, bathed in cool perspiration, turned falteringly and began to mount to the second floor. In the upper hall, he addressed another nurse who approached him. "I want to see my child," Mr. Button almost shrieked. He was on the verge of collapse. "Come this way then, Mr. Button." He dragged himself after her. At the end of a long hall, they reached a room from which proceeded a variety of howls. They entered. "Well," gasped Mr. Button, "which is mine?" "There," said the nurse. Mr. Button's eyes followed her pointing finger, and this is what he saw. Wrapped in a voluminous white blanket and partly crammed into one of the cribs, there sat an old man, apparently about 70 years of age. His sparse hair was almost white, and from his chin dripped a long, smoke-colored beard, which waved absurdly back and forth, fanned by the breeze coming in at the window. He looked up at Mr. Button with dim, faded eyes, in which lurked a puzzled question. "Am I mad?" thundered Mr. Button, his terror resolving into rage. "Is this some ghastly hospital joke?" "It doesn't seem like a joke to us," replied the nurse severely, "and I don't know whether you're mad or not, but that is most certainly your child." He closed his eyes and then, opening them, looked again. There was no mistake. He was gazing at a man of 70, a baby of 70, a baby whose feet hung over the sides of the crib. The old man looked placidly from one to the other for a moment, and then suddenly spoke in a cracked and ancient voice. "Are you my father?" he demanded. "Because if you are, I wish you'd get me out of this place, or at least get them to put a comfortable rocker in here." "Where in God's name did you come from? Who are you?" burst out Mr. Button frantically. "I can't tell you exactly who I am," replied the querulous whine, "because I've only been born a few hours, but my last name is certainly Button." "You lie. You're an imposter." The old man turned wearily to the nurse. "Nice way to welcome a newborn child," he complained in a weak voice. "Tell him he's wrong, why don't you?" "You're wrong, Mr. Button," said the nurse. "This is your child, and you'll have to make the best of it. We're going to ask you to take him home with you as soon as possible, sometime today." "Home?" repeated Mr. Button incredulously. "Yes, we can't have him here. We really can't." "I'm right glad of it," whined the old man. "This is a fine place to keep a youngster of quiet tastes. With all this yelling and howling, I haven't been able to get a wink of sleep. I asked for something to eat." Here his voice rose to a shrill note of protest. "And they brought me a bottle of milk." Mr. Button sank down upon a chair near his son and concealed his face in his hands. My heavens, he murmured. What will people say? What must I do? You'll have to take him home, insisted the nurse. Immediately. I can't, he moaned. People would stop to speak to him on the street. And what was he going to say? He would have to introduce this septuagenarian. This is my son, born early this morning. Come, pull yourself together, commanded the nurse. See here, the old man announced suddenly. If you think I'm going to walk home in this blanket, you're entirely mistaken. Keep it on, said Mr. Button. He turned to the nurse. What'll I do? Go downtown and buy your son some clothes. Mr. Button's son's voice followed him down the hall. And a cane, father. I want to have a cane. Chapter 2. Good morning, Mr. Button said nervously to the clerk in the Chesapeake Dry Goods Company. I want to buy some clothes for my child. How old is your child, sir? About 6 hours, answered Mr. Button, without due consideration. Baby supply department in the rear. Why, I don't think, I'm not sure that's what I want. He's an unusually large-sized child. Exceptionally large. They have the largest child sizes. Where is the boys' department? Inquired Mr. Button, shifting his ground desperately. He felt that the clerk must surely scent his shameful secret. Right here. But a frantic inspection of the boys' department revealed no suits to fit the newborn Button. He blamed the store, of course. In such cases, it is the thing to blame the store. How old did you say that boy of yours was? Demanded the clerk curiously. He's 16. Oh, I beg your pardon. I thought you said 6 hours. You'll find the youth's department in the next aisle. Mr. Button turned miserably away. Then he stopped, brightened, and pointed his finger toward the window display. There, he exclaimed. I'll take that suit out there on the dummy. Wrap it up. That's what I want. The astonished clerk obeyed. Back at the hospital, Mr. Button entered the nursery and almost threw the package at his son. Here's your clothes, he snapped out. The old man untied the package and viewed the contents with a quizzical eye. They sort of look funny to me, he complained. I don't want to be made a monkey of. You've made a monkey of me, retorted Mr. Button fiercely. Never mind how funny you look. Put them on or I'll spank you. He swallowed uneasily at the penultimate word, feeling, nevertheless, that it was the proper thing to say. All right, father, this with a grotesque simulation of filial respect. You've lived longer. You know best, just as you say. As before, the sound of the word father caused Mr. Button to start violently and hurry. I'm hurrying, father. When his son was dressed, Mr. Button regarded him with depression. The costume consisted of dotted socks, pink pants, and a belted blouse with a wide white collar. Over the latter waved the long whitish beard, drooping almost to the waist. The effect was not good. Wait, Mr. Button seized a hospital shears and with 3 quick snaps amputated a large section of the beard. But even with this improvement, the ensemble fell far short of perfection. The remaining brush of scraggly hair, the watery eyes, the ancient teeth, seemed oddly out of tone with the gaiety of the costume. Mr. Button, however, held out his hand. "Come along," he said sternly. His son took the hand trustingly. "What are you going to call me, Dad?" he quavered as they walked from the nursery. "Just Baby for a while, till you think of a better name?" Mr. Button grunted. "Ugh, I don't know," he answered harshly. "I think we'll call you Methuselah." Chapter 3. Even after the new addition to the Button family had had his hair cut short and then dyed to a sparse, unnatural black, had had his face shaved so close that it glistened, and had been attired in small boy clothes made to order by a flabbergasted tailor, it was impossible for Button to ignore the fact that his son was a sorry excuse for a first family baby. Despite his aged stoop, Benjamin Button, for it was by this name they called him, instead of by the appropriate but invidious Methuselah, was 5 feet 8 inches tall. His clothes did not conceal this, nor did the clipping and dyeing of his eyebrows disguise the fact that the eyes under were faded and watery and tired. In fact, the baby nurse who had been hired in advance left the house after one look. But Mr. Button persisted in his unwavering purpose. Benjamin was a baby, and a baby he should remain. At first, he declared that if Benjamin didn't like warm milk, he could go without food altogether. But he was finally prevailed upon to allow his son bread and butter, and even oatmeal, by way of a compromise. One day, he brought home a rattle, and, giving it to Benjamin, insisted in no uncertain terms that he should play with it, whereupon the old man took it with a weary expression and could be heard jingling it obediently at intervals throughout the day. There can be no doubt, though, that the rattle bored him and that he found other and more soothing amusements when he was left alone. For instance, Mr. Button discovered one day that during the preceding week he had smoked more cigars than ever before, a phenomenon which was explained a few days later when, entering the nursery unexpectedly, he found the room full of faint blue haze and Benjamin, with a guilty expression on his face, trying to conceal the butt of a dark Havana. This, of course, called for a severe spanking, but Mr. Button found that he could not bring himself to administer it. He merely warned his son that he would stunt his growth. Nevertheless, he persisted in his attitude. He brought home lead soldiers. He brought toy trains. He brought large, pleasant animals made of cotton. And, to perfect the illusion which he was creating, for himself at least, he passionately demanded of the clerk in the toy store whether the paint would come off the pink duck if the baby put it in his mouth. But despite all his father's efforts, Benjamin refused to be interested. He would steal down the back stairs and return to the nursery with a volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica, over which he would pore through an afternoon while his cotton cows and his Noah's Ark were left neglected on the floor. Against such a stubbornness, Mr. Button's efforts were of little avail. The sensation created in Baltimore was at first prodigious. What the mishap would have cost the Buttons and their kinsfolk socially cannot be determined, for the outbreak of the Civil War drew the city's attention to other things. A few people who were unfailingly polite racked their brains for compliments to give to the parents, and hit upon the ingenious device of declaring that the baby resembled his grandfather, a fact which, due to the standard state of decay common to all men of 70, could not be denied. Mr. and Mrs. Roger Button were not pleased, and Benjamin's grandfather was furiously insulted. Benjamin, once he left the hospital, took life as he found it. Several small boys were brought to see him, and he spent a stiff-jointed afternoon trying to work up an interest in tops and marbles. He even managed, quite accidentally, to break a kitchen window with a stone from a slingshot, a feat which secretly delighted his father. Thereafter, Benjamin contrived to break something every day, but he did these things only because they were expected of him, and because he was, by nature, obliging. When his grandfather's initial antagonism wore off, Benjamin and that gentleman took enormous pleasure in one another's company. They would sit for hours, these two, so far apart in age and experience, and, like old cronies, discuss with tireless monotony the slow events of the day. Benjamin felt more at ease in his grandfather's presence than in his parents. They seemed always somewhat in awe of him, and, despite the dictatorial authority they exercised over him, frequently addressed him as Mr. He was as puzzled as anyone else at the apparently advanced age of his mind and body at birth. He read up on it in the medical journal, but found that no such case had been previously recorded. At his father's urging, he made an honest attempt to play with other boys, and frequently he joined in the milder games. Football shook him up too much, and he feared that in case of a fracture, his ancient bones would refuse to knit. When he was 5, he was sent to kindergarten, where he was initiated into the art of pasting green paper on orange paper, of weaving colored maps, and manufacturing eternal cardboard necklaces. He was inclined to drowse off to sleep in the middle of these tasks, a habit which both irritated and frightened his young teacher. To his relief, she complained to his parents, and he was removed from the school. The Roger Buttons told their friends that they felt he was too young. By the time he was 12 years old, his parents had grown used to him. Indeed, so strong is the force of custom that they no longer felt that he was different from any other child, except when some curious anomaly reminded them of the fact. But one day, a few weeks after his 12th birthday, while looking in the mirror, Benjamin made, or thought he made, an astonishing discovery. Did his eyes deceive him, or had his hair turned in the dozen years of his life from white to iron gray under its concealing dye? Was the network of wrinkles on his face becoming less pronounced? Was his skin healthier and firmer, with even a touch of ruddy winter color? He could not tell. He knew that he no longer stooped, and that his physical condition had improved since the early days of his life. Can it be? He thought to himself, or rather, scarcely dared to think. He went to his father. "I am grown," he announced determinedly. "I want to put on long trousers." His father hesitated. "Well," he said finally, "I don't know. 14 is the age for putting on long trousers, and you are only 12. "But you'll have to admit," protested Benjamin, "that I'm big for my age." His father looked at him with illusory speculation. "Oh, I'm not so sure about that. I was as big as you when I was 12. This was not true. It was all part of Roger Button's silent agreement with himself to believe in his son's normality. Finally, a compromise was reached. Benjamin was to continue to dye his hair. He was to make a better attempt to play with boys of his own age. He was not to wear his spectacles or carry a cane in the street. In return for these concessions, he was allowed his first suit of long trousers. Chapter 4. When Benjamin was 18, he was straight as a man of 50. He had more hair, and it was of a dark gray. His step was firm, his voice had lost its cracked quaver, and descended to a healthy baritone. So his father sent him up to Connecticut to take examinations for entrance to Yale College. Benjamin passed his examination and became a member of the freshman class. On the third day following his matriculation, he received a notification from Mr. Hart, the college registrar, to call at his office and arrange his schedule. Benjamin, glancing in the mirror, decided that his hair needed a new application of its brown dye, but an anxious inspection of his bureau drawer disclosed that the dye bottle was not there. Then he remembered he had emptied it the day before and thrown it away. He was in a dilemma. He was due at the registrar's in 5 minutes. There seemed to be no help for it. He must go as he was. He did. "Good morning," said the registrar politely. "You've come to inquire about your son." "Why, as a matter of fact, my name's Button," began Benjamin. But Mr. Hart cut him off. "I'm very glad to meet you, Mr. Button. I'm expecting your son here any minute." "That's me," burst out Benjamin. "I'm a freshman." The registrar frowned and glanced at a card before him. "Why, I have Mr. Benjamin Button's age down here as 18. "That's my age," asserted Benjamin, flushing slightly. The registrar pointed sternly to the door. "Get out," he said. "Get out of college and get out of town. You are a dangerous lunatic." "I am 18. Mr. Hart opened the door. "Well, I'll give you 18 minutes to get out of town." Benjamin walked away. But he was not fated to escape so easily. On his melancholy walk to the railroad station, he found that he was being followed by a group, then by a swarm, and finally by a dense mass of undergraduates. The word had gone around that a lunatic had passed the entrance examinations for Yale and attempted to palm himself off as a youth of 18. A fever of excitement permeated the college. Men ran hatless out of classes. The football team abandoned its practice and joined the mob. Professors' wives, with bonnets awry and bustles out of position, ran shouting after the procession, from which proceeded a continual succession of remarks aimed at the tender sensibilities of Benjamin Button. Soon he was running. He would show them. They would regret these ill-considered taunts. Safely on board the train for Baltimore, he stuck his head out the window. "You'll regret this," he shouted. The undergraduates laughed. It was the biggest mistake that Yale College ever made. And that, my friend, is where I shall leave you for now, inviting you to return to the life, the curious case of Benjamin Button. Sweet dreams. And yes, if Brad Pitt happens to show up in them at any age, then I'm sure we'll understand. Drift away. Good night.